probably in Arizona. Lucy dropped her voice. The FBI. Bastards. But why would they want Susie?
I don't know, said Manny. Mrs. Gutierrez, she said someone came to the house looking for the baby. Susie, she didn't want to tell them where the baby was. She wouldn't cooperate.
Lucy closed her eyes. She sat quietly, tilting her head to one side.
When did she go?
A week ago, maybe.
A week. 1 week. What day is it today?
Lucy called out to Nurse Bob.
Friday, said Bob. Today is Friday.
Alone once more, Lucy Bach paced the halls, buffing the floor tiles with her paper slippers. Tall Paul said hello, attempted to catch her eye. She did not respond.
What's wrong, baby?
Said Loco Coco, shuffling beside her.
I did it.
Did what? You didn't do nothing, baby.
I did, said Lucy. I did it, and now she's gone.
Who's gone? Said Coco. You've been here this whole time. I know it. I'm your roommate, remember?
Coco followed at Lucy's heels, lapping the unit until they reached their room, watched her climb into bed.
Hey, guess what?
What?
Said Lucy.
I'm getting out soon.
Out.
Out of here.
Lucy frowned.
Where are you going?
Coco didn't answer. She pictured her nephew's two-room apartment, its filthy kitchen, grease caked on the counters, sink overflowing with cloudy water. She'd sleep, cramped, on a twin futon couch infested with fleas, surrounded by old newspapers stacked to the ceiling. Better than the floor. She'd tried that, too. The worn spot on the rug in front of the TV tuned to a sports channel, and she hated boxing, wrestling, ultimate fighting, and her nephew hated having her there. That show about the hoarders, about the woman found dead, partially devoured by her 16 cats, it could happen to her in there. But if not there, where?
Susie. Susie's gone.
Lucy clutched a pillow to her chest.
Your baby? She's all right. Didn't that boyfriend of yours say just today she's doing great?
Coco could not extract any further information. Her roommate lay in bed for the rest of the day, buried under a sheet. Coco listened to her sniffle, cough, whisper, cry. When it had been quiet a while, she wondered if Lucy had fallen asleep. She tiptoed over, poked at the lump. When it didn't move, she lifted the sheet.
"We need help,"
mumbled Lucy. Her forehead was sweaty, her eyes opened wide.
"Susie needs help," she said.
"Who is Susie?" asked Coco.
"My hermanita," said Lucy. "My friend."
"I thought I was your friend,"
said Coco, pissed. Visitors always messed up everything. Miranda curled into a ball on her flowery bedspread, stared out her motel window to the night on Route 9. Speeding red and yellow dots, triangles of fluorescent white, snow falling sideways, until, finally, the quiet dark.
"Extremely high-functioning, Your Honor. She has insight when she's well. We lost our mother to cancer. The stress, Your Honor, a trigger, no doubt. And she has a baby now. A beautiful baby girl, 4 months old. A baby deserves a proper mother, Your Honor. She can be a good mother when she's well. She speaks 5 languages. She plays the violin. She was always excellent at puzzles as a child. She's genuine. She's warm. She plays well with others. Can't you see? She doesn't deserve this, Your Honor. She's my sister, Your Honor. She's my family, Your Honor. I love her. I need her back.
Who knows why they do it? You'd drive yourself crazy trying to figure it out. If it was something you said, or the doctor said, or the social, or the medical student, or the janitor, or God, or those gods muttering insults in their ears. Maybe it was the ex-husband, the boyfriend, the sister, the roommate. Maybe it was the threat of court. Maybe it was a tidbit seen on Family Feud, read in Better Homes and Gardens, heard at group, or overheard in the visitor's lounge. Or maybe, as Bob most often surmised, they just couldn't stand it anymore. Being here. Whatever the reason, she did it. One morning, Lucy Buck grabbed the white pill, opened her mouth, downed it with a thick gulp of water. She remained compliant thereafter. Day by day, the staff observed her, her mind ever more present in her body. She seemed to unfurl like a fern receiving water. She was pleasant, polite, communicative. She volunteered in group. She played ping pong, tended to the plants, helped organize the boxes in the self-care room. Manuel visited, brought her cartons full of rice and beans and garlicky stews. Charo was glad to see he seemed attentive, competent. She called a meeting in her office.
"I'm ready to leave," said Lucy.
"Yes, I believe you are," said Charo, smiling. The treatment team was already looking at discharge dates. "What do you think?"
"She's doing great on the Zyprexa," said Miranda. The boyfriend nodded. He'd sat in shock the first time Charo briefed him on the illness. Explained to him in careful Spanish that there was no cure, only management and vigilance. Relapses were likely, routine was key. Sleep, stress management, of course the medications. He was given pamphlets. Treatment options, FAQs for caregivers, bipolar symptoms and signs. Miranda, engulfed by a torrent of sympathy, could not look at him.
"I love my daughter," was what he had said. "My daughter needs her mother, so for my daughter, I will try."
Nurse Bob agreed. It was a remarkable recovery. The girl had shown insight, which he hoped would continue to improve. And that sister, softening with relief in front of their very eyes. Miranda patted Lucia's arm. Charo smiled again. "No one said it. I told you so." Esperanza was a beautiful baby. Each staff member cooed when they saw her, shrieked when she cooed in return. "She's just gorgeous," they said, patting Manuel on the back. "And what a darling outfit that is." They pinched the toes of her duck-footed yellow pajamas, patted her pink fleece hooded jacket with ears. Charo nodded and smiled to each of them, as proud as if the baby were her own. Nothing was more wondrous than a baby, especially in a psychiatric ward. She escorted Manuel to the nursery. This was what they called the small windowless visiting room stocked with a few random soft toys, a rocking chair, a handful of children's books. It was private, secure. Lucy Bach sat, waiting.
"Essie," she said. "Oh, God, Essie, you're here."
Manuel carefully handed her the baby. She gazed at her daughter, stroked her forehead, her chin, her nose, her cheek, rosy from the cold outside. Then she rested the baby's torso across her chest, Essie's head on her shoulder. She patted her back, kissed her hair.
"Essie, Essie, Essie."
Lucy closed her eyes, and the baby smiled, content with the scent of her mother, occasionally turning her head as if to check that she was still there. Charo found herself looking away, eyes blurry, cheeks wet. She left them alone, relieved. On the day of her departure, Lucy spent the morning in the library, filling out discharge forms. By the time she finished, it was almost lunchtime. The exit plan was in place. She had been assigned to the hospital's intensive day program, 3 days a week for 12 weeks. Following that, she would transition to outpatient care with a psychiatrist once a month. Psychotherapy, family counseling, and follow-up with a social worker were strongly recommended. Her prescriptions had been faxed to the pharmacy on Main Street. Nurse Bob poked his head in as she was packing her things into a small duffel bag. "You all set?" he said.
"I think so," said Lucy.
She glanced around the room. Noon rays bounced off the glossy white walls. The beds donned fresh white sheets. She looked radiant, alive. Swung her hips as she marched down hallway B, dressed in a purple ski jacket, furry boots, hair bouncing on her shoulders. Big Juan Lopez whistled.
"Oye, mamacita," he called.
"Where's Coco?" said Lucy. "I need to say goodbye to Coco."
The armchair by the window sat empty. Outside, the sun shone. Much of the snow had melted. Lucy walked over to examine the cluster of potted plants, fingered their leaves, prodded their soil. She nodded, satisfied.
"Has anyone seen Coco?" she said.
Charo touched her arm lightly.
"Coco was transferred to a medical unit."
"But she was scheduled to leave today, wasn't she?"
Lucy blinked, confused.
"She said she wanted to leave together."
"Stabbed herself in the eye with a chopstick," shouted Big Juan. "They don't call her Loco Coco for nothing."
To Nurse Bob and the treatment team, it had come as no great surprise, but he saw the shock on Lucy's face.
"Is it true?" she asked.
"This morning. I'm sorry, but she'll be all right."
She frowned, deep in thought, clearly saddened. "Patient exhibits appropriate emotional response." He took it as a sign of her continuing recovery. Nurse Bob wondered if it would make a difference in her outcome, that the choice had ultimately been her own to take the pills.
"Could it have been..." Her eyes darted. "Something I said?"
Nurse Bob sighed. He shook his head.
"No, doll. She did it to herself."
Manuel Vargas stood by the nurse's station, holding a colorful bouquet of flowers.
"You go on," said Bob. "God bless Lucy, and good luck. I bet that baby girl of yours can't wait to see you again."
Lucy Bach spent a total of 40 days in Croat 6. Bob knew the odds were against her, that she would most likely be back. But if anyone could beat the odds, she could. Chapter 4. Lucia.
First thing I noticed about Manny, the mole on his left cheek, a perfect circle, the size of a dime, and smack middle like a doorbell. A mole, you say? He has such lovely features. Crinkly brown eyes, prominent brow ridges, a soft, fleshy philtrum above his soft, juicy lips. The mole was distracting. Not that it bothered him. He never touched it when nervous or favored the other side. We went to a Dominican bar and danced bachata, and he pressed it into my forehead, just above my left eye. And it was big and round and black, but not hairy or scary, and his breath was cinnamon gum. As the night wore on, I wanted to lick it, taste it. Later, snapped awake and sizzled electric. I was convinced it was a recording device, a secret camera, that it would activate with a correct fingerprint or retinal identification, and officers from some central compound would descend like flying monkeys, gather me and take me away. His essence? A dog. The coloring of a German shepherd, with on-guard ears and that sharp, wolf-like masculinity bordering on feral, rabid. But I detected something gentle, even fragile underneath. The way he stood in public, not quite raised to full height, hands in his pockets, downcast eyes. I knew he was an illegal. Skittish.
"You know what's sad?" he said, one of those first evenings we sat together in front of the Vargas house, under the summer moon, holding hands.
"What?" I said. He pointed down the street to a frail-looking elderly couple, trying to maneuver an L-shaped couch into a U-Haul van. They kept banging it into the side of the door.
"Wait here," he said.
I knew he was decent, kind. He could lift heavy weights. What I didn't know about Manny. I didn't know he would stick by me and my baby girl.
"And is this a good thing?"
"This is me at the P-Docs. He's tapping one big brown shoe. Short, long, short, short, long. It must be a professional no-no, but he's oblivious." "A good thing?" "Sure, I guess so." "He's new. A mandatory assignment since I finished with my 12-week outpatient follow-up program at the hospital. Older, bland blonde face, side-part hair, and overall beigeness. Though he's irregularly tall, thus also a bit grasshopper-like. Uncomfortable when seated, like he's had to accordion his limbs to fit into some toddler's chair. Not much interested in moles or surveillance or even balmy recollections of romance. He wants to know how I'm doing for support." "Support?"
"Yes."
He's already run the standard battery of questions. Checked the checkboxes, computed the data. Here's voices equals schizophrenic. Too agitated equals paranoid. Too bright equals manic. Too moody equals bipolar. And, of course, everyone knows a depressive, a suicidal, and if you're all around too unruly or obstructive or treatment-resistant like a superbug, you get slapped with a personality disorder, too. In Crote 6, they said I suffer from schizoaffective disorder. That's like the sampler plate of diagnoses, best of everything. But I don't want to suffer. I want to live. I sit up straight, one hand on my lower back, the other on my belly. I take a deep inhale. Control top pantyhose? Two lace-up corsets, Spanx, one traditional postpartum faja.
Oh, support.
He doesn't smile. He is not mildly amused. My parents are dead, and my sister lives in Switzerland. Time's up. The face, not a crack, ungiving as stone. Ay-ya. He sends me away with a prescription. I go away. I run away. I get in my car. It's raining. My windshield wipers drag as they swipe a raggedy sound. One small boy's would erupt into giggles over because all they can think of is farts. All I can think is, it's not like the old days, when some stoical psychoanalyst would hear you out for hours and hours, withholding judgment while you lay on their sofa, expelling your word-salad thoughts and florid delusions. Nowadays, it's about pharma, drugs, and it hardly matters that all those tangled thoughts originate from a sentient being, a real person. Not a lone frontal cortex with its wiring gone awry, though you could picture it, that renegade mass all veiny and purplish and intestinal-looking. I drive to Cousin Delia's house. She's not really Manny's cousin, but it doesn't matter. Essie loves her and her two older girls. Today, Essie's new trick? She crawls. Backward. I sweep her up, press her cheek to my cheek. Sweetie girl, I say. My bow bow, my Iha. The life in her body so buttery warm. Ba, she says, a finger in my eye. That beaming face. This is the best part about leaving her, to come back to this. We go pick up Manny. This is the routine, twice a day, because Manny hates to drive. He works as a line cook at the Porky Pig, the 24-hour diner where he started as a dishwasher. Despite its name, it's a local hotspot with a certain cachet, the kind of joint where you find mini jukeboxes in each booth and ogre-sized portions on heavy white plates, except for the orange juice, fresh squeezed, that comes in single-gulp glasses. Manny claims celebrities go there all the time, but he hasn't spotted one yet, personally. Today I bring Essie inside. There's a fried chicken special for us early birds, and Manny loves fried chicken.
How is the doctor? He asks.
Starchy, I say.
Como a potato?
He picks up a French fry, waves it in the air. I pick up a French fry, wave it back. Exactly, I say.
Huh.
Two fries later, a grin sneaks across his face.
Rico, no?
He does a yum-yum tap on Essie's belly until she laughs. This is Manny on a good day. I kick him under the table.
But you'll go back, he says.
It's a question or not a question, I can't tell, but he's very serious. I'm supposed to, I say. It's an answer or not an answer, but he says,
okay,
reaches over and squeezes my hand. His is always a little bit clammy. When Esperanza was born, a pair of serpents lived inside my head. Their job was to warn me of the dangers of motherhood, which boiled down to this.
If you touch your baby, she will die.
My body, commandeered, a vessel of evil, was leaking evil into my child. The serpents spoke in opposite voices. If one was soft, the other was loud. If one politely reminded me to keep my hands to myself, the other said I deserved to have my arms lopped off for not listening. They scrutinized my every move.
She is removing the baby's diaper. She is wiping the baby's bum. The baby is crying. See, the baby is no good. Cheap, defective. Don't touch baby like that. Chop it off. Return to the proper authorities for a refund.
12 touches, they said. 12 more touches. Then my baby, contaminated, would die. I didn't tell anyone. First, it was a secret. Second, I was ashamed. Third, I couldn't stand to hear the human population's efforts to convince me it wasn't true. You're sick! You're sick! That was all part of the plot. So I wore thin cotton socks over my hands, dressed my baby in layers, cocooned her in blankets, avoided her skin coming into contact with mine. If I did as I was told, I hoped they might spare her. But it was hard to be a good mother like that. So this is me with Essie, 8 months old, in the basement of the First Unitarian Church. A circle of women, all new mothers, has turned its attention on us. The group facilitator starts each session with a question, and today's icebreaker is,
what were your first thoughts as you held your baby?
Standard answers seem to be miracle and love, though one woman, a cat-like Pakistani with glassy green eyes, has nerve enough to say,
not much, truthfully. But
I can't exactly tell the truth. Blessed, I say, taking in all the breasts around me, both free-flying and poking out of nursing bras. I've never seen so many breasts before. Pointy, droopy, splotchy, smooth, jiggly, perky, flat, like the seven dwarves. I imagine their cartoon voices. I felt scared, but blessed. The mothers bobbed their heads. I can tell this is an excellent answer. The woman to my left, cross-legged on the floor, makes googly eyes at Essie. This is a sign a mama likes you, if she genuinely tries to make your kid laugh. She has a greenish complexion, oblong breasts that splay apart, and when her son, in her lap, tilts his chin upward, he can reach her and suck away. Hands free. Very impressive. Eggplant. Definitely eggplant. And when this comes to me, something inside my stomach topples over. I think of my sister, Jie. Okay, me. What am I? Oh, Jie, that's easy. A porcupine. For some reason, I'm remembering all of Jie's floors. The ones I slept on over the years. 3 different dorm rooms in college, a shared studio in Chelsea, partitioned off with a world map shower curtain, a 1-bedroom sublet in Gramercy Park, the only available spot in the hallway with a mangy dog, a loft space in Tribeca, the apartment she shared with her friend Tess in Washington Heights, where she had to smuggle me and my boyfriend in and out through the fire escape. Wherever she lived, whenever I visited, as her starry-eyed Maymay, as a restless teen, as an itinerant college grad, she would blow up the air mattress, unroll her red Coleman sleeping bag. Here you go, Lucia. It used to be simple like that. Now Jie mostly stays away, swoops in only to unleash her wrath upon whichever person of importance she deems most incompetent. She stuck around until I was sprung from the P ward, then swooped back to Switzerland. I'd say I felt 95% relieved when she left, 5% like an abandoned cat. But, well, she would have gotten a kick out of these mamas anyway. After introductions, we go back around the circle to discuss the most challenging moments of our weeks. With the newborns, the gist of anxiety seems to be that they won't eat. For older babies, it's that they'll never learn to sleep. I don't have much to say about it, because Essie is a good eater and sleeper. But I know I shouldn't say that, so I say, Essie throws up in her car seat. Oh, no! Some of the mamas cover their mouths in an oh-no way. Some of them, like it might be contagious. Regularly? Says Eggplant. Is it spit up or vomit? Does she have reflux? Had she just eaten beforehand? How much does she weigh? The mothers chime in, but I know spit up from vomit, and it only happens in the car. And Essie eats or drinks every few hours, so it's hard to say. I've talked to the pediatric nurse, who had me come into the office, but Dr. Vera Wang gave Essie only a cursory inspection, asked a few questions, then told me everything would be fine. It's just a phase, she said. It'll be okay. And you, are you doing okay? The way she asked in that raised eyebrow way without actually raising her eyebrows made me suspect that she knew, and I thought maybe I should just come out and say it. Yes, I'm taking my meds. But it isn't really any of her business. Sometimes the biggest challenge is just staying awake, I say. The mothers laugh, bob in agreement, roll their knowing eyes. This makes me feel good somehow, to think I've broken some ice. I go back to that group a few more times. It's an odd mix of people,
Lots of older, hand-wringing Westchester housewives, a few immigrant women, two teenagers. But it's sweet how everyone tries to get along. Faith, a.k.a. Eggplant, invites me on a coffee date, and Essie sleeps the whole time, while her baby fusses and she has to keep lifting up this sunflower nursing cover that's like a giant apron. And it's like, sunflower, breast, sunflower, breast. And I get so distracted I can barely carry on a conversation. So she talks, mostly about her complicated pregnancy and how blessed she feels that her doula was able to help her follow her birthing plan and how she got through her natural labor in spite of the pushy OB who was all ready to go C-section. I admire Faith's ability to withstand pain, but all her words make me kind of tired. The woman I like best is Nipa, the cat-eyed Pakistani who confides to the group that she's a breast cancer survivor, 2 years in remission. After this, I notice some mamas try to sit closer, to absorb her strength, while others seem to shy away.
"Isn't that, like, irresponsible?"
I overhear one of the Westchester housewives say. And I kind of hate her forever right on the spot. Nipa and I meet in town. A crisp fall day, perfect for strolling down Main Street. We wheel past Pizza Palace and the Korean grocery and the laundromat where the door is propped open, and I'm comforted by the detergent-y fresh thuds and clangs. "This is where I met Essie's dad," I say.
"No way. That's so romantic comedy," says Nipa.
And I have to laugh. We head to the waterfront, where the wind picks up, and the river shimmers, all zigzagged, and yellow leaves start to fly. When we reach the playground, Nipa confides to me that her doctor thinks she's suffering from postpartum depression. I'm floored. First, she is telling me. Second, she's wearing makeup and her hair is clean, and her nady is perfectly cherubic with his rolls of chin fat and cream bun cheeks. "It's weird," she says. "In all these years, no one's ever told me I suffered from cancer. I'm a fighter, a survivor, you know."
"That is strange," I say.
She doesn't seem sad, not like Jazz, the girl in Croat 6, whose eyeballs were permanently glued to her feet. But Nipa says she's cried every day since her nady was born. "It seems silly, right? To be crying when everything's fine?" "Well, why not, I figure. Because if pain and tears were correlated, surely we would have all drowned by now."
"Or we'd be living on arcs," says Nipa.
And for a second, I'm confused, until I realize I've spoken aloud. She sweeps up her hair, piles it on top of her head, and it stays there like a big brown donut.
"Do you feel hopeless?"
"Maybe.
How do I tell? I feel so wishy-washy."
She reaches down to pry a wood chip from Nady's mouth. I suggest we move closer to the swings, where the ground is that foamy rubber made from recycled tires. But she doesn't want to deprive the kids of their tactile exploration.
"It's really hard," I say.
That's usually the best thing to say. It occurs to me that no condition covered in the DSM-IV is ever followed by the word survivor. But I don't mention this.
"Are you seeing someone?" I ask.
She blinks, quizzical.
"I'm married," she says, and I'm so embarrassed I have to lean forward to pretend wipe Essie's face.
I meant like a shrink. She asks whether I'm working, and I say I hope to again soon. My last job, I wrote features for a newspaper in Queens. Nipa taught high school math in the Bronx for 12 years, started the week after her college graduation, continued through her treatments, but quit when Nady was born.
"Now I feel stupid and useless," she says.
"Oh, I feel stupid and useless too," I say, and her cat eyes glow a little brighter. I tell Nipa, I used to cry all the time too. She asks why, but I can't bring myself to say. Even the thought of it makes me feel ashamed. The serpents invaded my head after Essie was born. I would sit in my bedroom, not moving for hours, terrified to wake them. Flanked by banana plants, oriented by the window, my knees pointed precisely to 2 o'clock. I needed to align my body with the Earth's magnetic field, like a grazing cow or caribou. Only this way could my innermost thoughts resist detection by the mind X-rays from Central Compound. Any sudden movement or breach in concentration, I was sure, could have cosmic consequences, like causing an Olympic figure skater to miss her triple lutz, or a driver to plow onto a snowy sidewalk, or an airplane to fall out of the sky. But even within silence, the stimuli flourished. Photons in the sunlight made my skin itch. Tiny creatures stampeded in the walls. Invisible rays from the light sockets leached vital chi from my meridians. Sometimes I heard babies. "Can you hear that?" I'd ask Manny.
"What?"
"They're crying."
"Who?"
"The babies."
"No, Lucia," he said, pointing to the bassinet. "Essie is asleep."
The serpents, they mocked me.
"Stupid girl! Made you look!"
Then I understood. All the crying babies were a recording played by Central, an evil trick to divert my attention from my child. I would outsmart them, ignore them. But I ended up ignoring Essie's cries, too. Finally, Manny got angry, threw his temper around, and when he insisted on having Susie's sister, Betty, watch Essie in her home, I gave in. Then I was consumed by guilt. I kept the socks on my hands, like a scarlet letter, even when I was alone. One time, as punishment, I gulped down half a bottle of laxative, then crawled next door to Mrs. Gutierrez's garden and lay on her flowerbed. The ground was frozen. It was middle of winter, but I was sure if I focused intensely enough, I could will a daffodil up from the earth. If this happened, I reasoned, it would be proof that my body had been cleansed of its poison. 3 hours later, Mrs. Gutierrez found me prowling on my hands and knees. "I can't find them," I mumbled.
"Find what?"
she asked. "My fingers and toes. They were numb." She brought me inside. The warmth of her house smelled suspicious, like vitamins and beef broth and soap.
"You need a doctor?"
She peeled the socks from my hands, touched my fingers, frozen like grape popsicles.
"Maybe I need to take you to a doctor," she said.
No way. I knew better. A doctor would send me to the lockup hospital for sure. Mrs. G pressed hot washcloths to my face, wrapped my hands and feet in iron-warmed towels, brought me a bowl of hot soup. 2 sips and I ran to the toilet, stayed bolted there for over an hour. The serpents hissed. One giggled, one cursed. Slowly, I regained sensation. It burned. When the serpents were awake, my first instinct was to muzzle them by turning up the television. But electromagnetic waves were bad for the baby, and if Manny was home, he'd shut it off. I knew he worried, sensed his thoughts in distress, and I wanted desperately to tell him I'd find some way to care for our daughter. But by that point, I found it hard to speak. My mouth moved, but to form the correct sounds seemed impossible. Well, words were a trick, too easily intercepted by Central. I'd need to devise a telepathic code. Witness protection program meant home. Bread meant poison. Awake meant scared. And Essie was my pancake, or pet, or our bumblebee. Of course, this schema ended up being far too complicated. Just thinking about it left me exhausted. Mute. Some days, I tried to seek refuge in the loudest place I could find, like Pizza Palace or the laundromat or a fitness class at the Y. But people were risky. Spies gossiped and conspired to wring out my thoughts like they wrung out their wet gym towels. They knew who I was, in spite of my disguise as a sweet Asian doll. She's trying to hide.
Why is she hiding?
It's time to open her up. Expose her. The Chinese restaurant in Greenberg turned out to be the most effective din, especially at lunch hour, when the serpents had to compete with the crowds, and when the noise thinned, I clamped on my headphones and blasted Ella Fitzgerald, who mourned for me as I lay down my chopsticks and washed my fingers in tea.
She's lying on the floor. She's curled up like a ball. She's crying. Are her eyes made for crying? Cut them out! Stop her crying now!
I stopped crying. My insides dried, cauterized. I had no tears left. But I wanted to die. After I entered the hospital, the voices quieted, but it didn't take too many brain cells to figure out that Croat 6 was an anagram for exorcist, and only one E shy of erotic sex. Central was broadcasting to China to teach people there about safe sex and mental hygiene. And while I was trapped in their prison, the FBI schemed to steal my baby. I called the police, the fire department, three city council members who turned me away. Help! Finally, Child Protective Services said they'd send someone to check on the baby. This made me feel slightly less agitated. I'd been in lockup before. I knew my rights. If I stayed calm, posed no immediate threat to myself or others, they'd have to let me go. I was the subject of a top-secret government experiment, a journalist working undercover on a sensational exposé, a finalist on a TV reality show. Any day now, they'd announce the results of the audience vote. The days passed. Little changed. My concerns faded in urgency, as life became its new routine. Mealtimes and groups, and ping-pong with Big Juan, the drama of Hulk and Loco Coco and the other patients in the unit. Gradually bleached of purpose, I'd stand by the windows, projecting my reflection onto the winter. I was the snow and the fog, and the wind and the cold. I was the blue scrub, accosted by other blue scrubs, illuminated by fluorescent white lights. But it was different this time, because of Essie. I had a baby now. They would never let me go. The doctors say I have insight. I can talk about the past, recognize something was wrong. But the truth is, I'm still not sure how to tell what's real. Because when you're inside it, it's your reality. And if your own perception of the world isn't valid, then what is? Here's what I do know. I spent a total of 40 days in Croat 6. I missed my baby's first laugh, first solid foods, first tooth. On the day I was finally released, Manny brought me flowers, a dozen Gerbera daisies, and drove the whole way home at exactly 2 miles under the speed limit. It felt fast. Whee! And it was spring, with tulips and daffodils and blossoms exploding from every tree. I wanted to yell, "I'm free!" "Can I do that?" I asked Manny.
"Oh, Jesus," he said.
He rolled his eyes. but I think he was really nervous.
Choking, jeez.
Doped up as I was, I still pinched his cheek, stuck my arm out the window, and waved to everyone on Main Street. We stopped at Cousin Delia's first. Essie sat on a plastic floor mat in the kitchen, scooping yogurt in the general direction of her mouth with her fingers. My baby, sitting up, feeding herself. I started to cry. I couldn't help it. When Manny had brought her into the pee ward, she'd seemed like a borrowed doll, something I couldn't possibly keep. Now, I kissed her yogurt-smeared face. I kissed Manny. I kissed Cousin Delia. I beamed the whole way home.
The house looked respectable. Some debris in the front yard, but a freshly swept stoop. Mrs. Gutierrez, no doubt. And only a few hardened food stains on the kitchen floor. A handful of dishes in the sink. Upstairs, I emptied my plastic bag full of personal belongings. Clothes got tossed into the laundry heap, toiletries restowed in the bathroom. I brushed my teeth, flossed, filled a cup and watered my banana plants. I named them Dusty, Dusty Two, and Parched. Lying back on the futon mattress, I studied their fronds, such lovely green veins. Neat and parallel, in contrast with the wild crisscross cracks on the ceiling. I sat back up. I pointed my knees to 2 o'clock. The room felt different. Once thick and seething, it now sat eerily still, as if it'd been depleted of some elemental particle. The Vargas boys acted like I'd never been gone.
"Everything is fine with your family?"
said Carlos. And I said yes, and no one asked me anything more. I figured Manny had explained my absence in whatever way he thought best, and I felt grateful to him for this. I knew the social had given him pamphlets and explained to him a lot of things, like how I had a very serious lifelong condition, and how to best speak to me in a supportive and non-threatening manner, and how very important it was that I take my pills, even though they would make me tired and I'd need extra rest. On the day of my own homecoming, I decided to bake Chinese almond cookies.
"The almonds are from China,"
said Hector. He laughed at his own joke, slid his stool closer to the small TV on the kitchen counter. "They're usually for special occasions," I explained. But he was too absorbed in the news. We all know Hector is in love with Mindy Griffin, the reporter on Channel 9 with the blonde halo hair and spectacular cleavage. The refrigerator hummed. The kettle boiled. Essie beat on a colander with a wooden spoon. Eventually, she whacked her finger. "Bad spoon. Bad, bad spoon," I said. I hugged her, kissed her, but she kicked and flailed and pushed me away, inconsolable for a good 15 minutes. "Essie, Iha," I pleaded over and over. "Mama's here. Essie, Mama's here." Finally, she pressed her wet face into my shoulder. When she fell asleep, I brought her upstairs, then returned to my mixing bowl. I strained my eardrums, now attuned to the frequencies of her doleful cries. But I heard no cries. Reports included a drunk driving accident on the Pelham Parkway, a house fire in White Plains, traffic on the Tappan Zee Bridge.
"You did that, right?"
"What?"
"You did that, right? Reporter. Manny said you used to do that, like on the news."
"Oh, right. Hector. I was a writer. I was on TV only once."
"Oh,"
he said.
"I thought..."
He pointed to the screen, started laughing.
"K-k-k."
Hector has a great laugh, like how a penguin would laugh if penguins laughed. So then I had to laugh, too. I beat together flour and butter and sugar and eggs. I watched Mindy Griffin. I waited. The screen flickered at me, but there was nothing. Or rather, there was something, but it felt far away, no longer in my realm of concern. Maybe for the serpents, it was like trying to talk in outer space with no air to conduct the sound. For the first few weeks, Manny went all domestic. Made the bed, folded laundry, cooked me breakfasts with chorizo and eggs. The Vargas boys were on their best behavior. But I missed Susie, my sweet Hermanita, with her denim jacket and miniskirts, who was always sprucing up the place with crepe paper streamers or vases of paper flowers or cakes with bright-colored frosting. She was taken away while I was stuck in the pee ward. And I'm convinced it was my fault. When I went to find her sister in Pleasantville, it turned out Betty had gone too, moved out of her apartment. Where would she go? I asked Manny. Back to Ecuador? He said he didn't know. These things happened, like with Jimmy Prieto. I could see it stressed him out to talk about it, so I didn't bring it up again. Soon after I came home, Essie got sick. She coughed and cried, broke out into a rash one night. The pills knocked me out. I didn't hear her. Manny called Dr. Vera Wang and took care of everything. The cough lasted for weeks. I told Manny he should wake me, but the one time he did, I was completely disoriented, changed her without putting a fresh diaper on, and in the morning she was covered with shit. Sorry, I said. I'm so sorry. I washed her in the shower, scrubbed the bed sheets and the tub, sprayed the mattress with bleach and vinegar. I didn't try to explain to Manny about the meds, how some days my head feels like it's been mulching underground for the duration of a New England winter, how they've tried me on 12 different drugs over the past 5 years. One made me gain 30 pounds, swell up like a balloon animal, all twisted and pinched and skin too tight for my body. Pop! The next pill caused headaches, the next diarrhea, the next shot me deep into a neuroleptic daze. They prescribed pills in combination, added pills for the side effects, then pills for side effects of the pills for side effects. They kept upping my Xanax. I couldn't feel. Finally, I said, no more pills. I take only one kind of medication now. They adjust the dosage. Sometimes I still slosh around, dense and slushy like a watermelon. Other times I'm flat, defizzed. And every night, Manny barges into the bathroom, hangs around until I finish brushing my teeth so he can watch me swallow the pills. After a few weeks of this, I can't take it. I tell him it makes me nervous, like I'm back in Croats 6. I'm not a prisoner anymore, and I refuse to be treated like one. This is me at the P-Docs again. It's slow going with Beige. But he's meticulous, at least, records everything in his notepad with his rollerball pen.
How's the fogginess? He says.
A little better, lighter, less San Francisco, more L.A.
Fog, less San Francisco, more L.A.
There must be a lot to parse in that statement, because he's scribbling away for a full minute.
I notice you've been rubbing your eyes.
Spring, I say, because everything has to have side effects, I guess. He doesn't smile. He jots again, asks if I'm familiar with tardive dyskinesia, and I say yes, I know. It's a nasty long-term side effect of the meds, where your tongue falls out of your mouth and you twitch and shake. He explains it anyway. neurological effects, etc., etc. So we can be mindful, as if I'm not already terrified.
How about the voices?
I say they've gone away, because the truth is, even if the whispers float around the edges, it's better than the zombie haze. Then he asks if there's anything particular on my mind today, something I'm hoping to get out of the session. For the first time, he sounds like a therapist. I tell him I'm looking for a job.
Oh, what kind of job?
Local news reporter, preferably a daily, but I'm looking into radio, maybe TV too.
I see,
he says. His tone stays even, but I catch the slip, the flinch, that arc of the brow, the subtle shift of weight. Well, I need a job, now that I'm not stuck in group therapy sessions every day, and I studied journalism. He nods, expressionless, rests his elbows on his knees, his chin on his loose, clasped hands. He's thinking a while, sorting his words. Finally, he says,
"Did your last therapist speak with you about setting attainable short-term goals?"
Attainable short-term goals? I picture an ice hockey rink, and he's wearing one of those creepy white masks with holes. Hannibal Lecter. I quickly blink him away.
"What I mean is," Beige continues, "don't you already have a very important job?"
Hannibal Lecter gone, my mind runs blank, so I scan the room with my eyes, the universal sign for, am I missing something? Then he is smiling at me, showing his teeth, yellowish. And this is a first, a landmark event. But still, I find nothing to say.
"Aren't you a mother?"
Beige unclasps his hands. "Oh." Hot embarrassment floods my body, though I'm not sure why. "Sure, I guess. I mean, yes, I am." He nods and nods and smiles. When I get in the car, I'm all fluttery. I sit on top of my hands. I say it out loud. "Fuck you!"
"He said that?" says Nipa. "A doctor said that?"
"Yeah.
That's so obnoxious. Fuck him."
I keep on looking. I scour the ads, send out resumes. I try for news reporter, cultural editor, arts magazine proofreader, radio show fact checker, web content manager, ghostwriter. One day, I'm with Essie at the laundromat, checking out the bulletin board while she's mesmerized by the dryers. I find an ad for art assistant at one of those paint-your-own pottery studios. I apply for that, too. What the hell? I apply, and I wait. Whenever I get called for an interview, I sling on my favorite pair of heels, red suede Mary Janes, tamed with my most conservative skirt. I'm overqualified, underqualified. The position is filled. But everyone compliments my shoes. To stay active, I assign myself projects, including a feature story on El Pollo Loco.
"El Pollo Loco?" says Manny. "Are you serious?"
But I get a good vibe from the chicken guy, in spite of the creepy rubber suit. And the suit, well, it's intriguing. We meet at a coffee shop. He's punctual. He takes off his chicken head, and he's early 50s, maybe. He won't confirm. Lean and Germanic, with chiseled features and pale gray eyes. Sweaty, intense, with an ants-in-the-pants energy too big to be confined indoors. So it's only mildly shocking to learn he's an ex-fighter pilot who flew in Iraq, with a daughter in her last year at Vassar. I ask the obvious question. Why?
"I am El Pollo Loco," he explains.
and when he puts on that suit every morning, it's like climbing into his own skin. There's something reassuring about this fixed identity.